Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I am thrilled to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Randall Amster. He is the director of the Program on Justice and Peace at Georgetown University and executive director of the Peace and Justice Studies Association. His new book is Peace Ecology. Randall Amster, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David.
So this is a great book, Peace Ecology. I think both people interested in peace and people interested in the environment, and I don't know why everybody isn't interested in both, should read it. What was the goal behind writing this book?
Well, I think you touched on it there, that we really need to have a joint interest in issues like peace and the environment. If there ever was a time when we could separate social issues from environmental issues, that time has long since passed. And we're increasingly faced with a series of crises in the world that demonstrate the interlinked nature of both the ways that we process conflict and the ways in which we interact with the larger environment.
And is that sort of merger between interests for peace and environment happening? And if not, how can it happen?
I think it's starting to happen. I mean, consciousness of it is probably lagging behind the actual engagement with it. For instance, when people are, moving for climate justice and straightforwardly dealing with issues of climate change, which, generationally is a very sobering thing to see the effects of it bearing fruit in real time rather than in, geological time. And as more people come to understand those kinds of processes, more and more people are making the connection to things, such as the military being a large consumer of fossil fuels and a contributor to the greenhouse emissions that drive that process. There's not always a direct, connecting the dots process involved, although increasingly I think we're beginning to see that that being the case. These things take time, but certainly the idea that issues don't happen in isolation, I think, is commonly understood among people who are advocates for peace and justice, that there's a holistic nature to these things, and some of the great icons in the peace and justice field, the Gandhis and the Kings, talked about this, that there is a deep-seated interconnection. You don't get justice in one sphere if you deny it in another. And so just extending the logic slightly further, we bring the environmental frame straightforwardly into being, and it starts to open up these possibilities of using actions and strategies and visions that are aimed at both. And it turns out they're both related and always have been, and so action in one sphere actually has a spillover benefit in another. The more we do that work, I think the closer we get to solutions that aren't piecemeal, and in some ways, the notion that we could stay in silos is really very outmoded and doesn't fit the interlinked network nature of the world that we're living in.
It seems like environmental activism is adopting more and more a sort of urgent life and death attitude that in the past was more common to opposition to war, I think. In fact, maybe more so. It may be that people are developing the idea that environmental activism is even more urgently needed than peace activism. What do you think?
I think they're on a par. I mean, I think you're right. There's no doubt that some of the environmental challenges, mountaintop removal and climate justice issues and a whole host of others, have definitely been increasing in their urgency, and for good reason. You don't have to comb too far beneath the headlines to get a sense that, that things are deteriorating, but also to get a sense that those processes contributing to those forms of environmental degradation are likewise contributing to profound levels of social inequality and the perpetuation of a military-industrial complex that's consuming so much of the resource. And the danger is that, when you prioritize one way of confronting problems in the world, namely a militaristic model, that tends to be the model that's deployed in every context. And so you're seeing a securitization of climate discourse. I mean, in some ways, people in the security and military industries have noted for a long time that climate change is a great threat to national security. What we don't want to see is the militarization of a response to those things. And so activists have been increasing and stepping up their urgency and also using many of the tactics and strategies long associated with peace activism, nonviolent civil disobedience, and all of the tools of peaceful change. So that merger is there. I think with this book, I was hoping to call some of that more self-consciously and straightforwardly out into the discourse.
Yeah, I think one point you made very well in the book was that it's sort of become accepted in the corporate media, in the New York Times, that climate change is a threat to national security, which seems rather absurd in that it's actually a threat to the globe. But how do we get around that idea that we're going to use the military to attack both wars and outbreaks of democracy and diseases in West Africa and climate change? It doesn't seem like the tool for addressing climate change to me.
No, and I think in many ways, you know, the military planners will honestly tell you that that tool is a fairly blunt one, and it's not useful in every context. You know, so even in their paradigm, they'll acknowledge that this isn't always the right tool for every job. But you know the old expression, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But in this case, it's even more, direct than that, that we've got $600 billion a year in hammers. You know, we've got nothing but hammers everywhere, all everywhere we look. And so, of course, we wind up treating every problem like a nail. You know, in some ways, I mean, and that's part of the reality that we're coping with at the grand scale. But in some ways, what really drove me to write the book was to try to find other ways of engaging these issues. So even though I spend some time in the book analyzing the complex interrelationships between militarism and environmental issues, I also try to flip that very same set of issues on its head and look at ways that people confronted with environmental crises have also used it as profound opportunities for peace building. And that aspect, I think, that answers your question, that if we're not willing to rely on the military model to solve our problems, whether it's disease or climate change or a whole range of other issues, post-disaster context, et cetera, then we need to be fashioning other viable alternatives. The more we can accrue some kind of architecture of showing how people in communities have the power and ability to manage these issues themselves, the less reliant they and we become on outside actors to come in and try to fix their problems for them.
So what are some examples of how people are establishing models we should seek to follow and expand on?
Some are very old and some are quite cutting edge. So on the very old side, I mean, any place you look around the world, people have evolved very elaborate systems of sharing, particularly around water, as a quintessential resource that we all rely upon, the one that no one can do without for a very brief period of time, basically. And on almost every continent around the world, people have evolved these very elaborate yet and subtle systems of sharing water, oftentimes in arid climates where, you know, the responsibility for maintaining the ducts that carry water is mutually shared and people govern them collectively. They take equal shares rather than, you know, first in time, first in right kind of logic. Those kind of models are still prevalent wherever you happen to look. Increasingly, they're under threat from forces of privatization and commercialization, but they're there, and we can use those as models to inspire and translate those systems into the modern era. One of the ways you see that play out today is in the post-disaster context, which has been well documented by writers including Rebecca Solnit and others, looking at how in the face of many of these man-made / natural disasters that we've seen in the last couple of decades, there has been a response by people on the ground working in concert with others who have come to help that has a very solidarity-based, do-it-yourself-together quality to it, where people suddenly rediscover their neighbors, begin sharing resources. That Hobbesian narrative that, you know, is often anticipated, that people will be, you know, unleashed and start, you know, competing over every morsel, is largely not the case. There are exceptions, but in general, this kind of community-based, solidarity-based response has been evident just about at every disaster that's been studied. So it suggests that we know how to do this, and we know how to do it when times are tough, and that's really the key. It's one thing to say we can share and get along when times are good, but can we do it in time when we're confronted with shortages and an emergency situation? My feeling is that, you know, it doesn't take much imagination to look at the world and see that it's a series of ongoing emergencies, and an acute disaster is just, you know, a concrete moment of that. But in general, we're experiencing a kind of slow and steady ongoing disaster in many spheres of our lives. Rather than waiting for, you know, things to really hit the fan, it seems to me that our better strategy is to begin to learn from from these examples and learn these lessons and start doing this more and more before the acute crises manifest. And hopefully, if we do that, we might actually just head them off in the first place, or at least mitigate their impact.
We are speaking with Randall Amster. His book is Peace Ecology. Randall, it's interesting that you bring up the term Hobbesian, because you have an interesting analysis of Thomas Hobbes in your book. And I had just recently read, and I think you may have read as well, Ian Morris's new book, What is War Good For?, in which he argues rather nonsensically, to my point of view, that it's good for everything and it brings us peace and stability. And he sort of frames Hobbes as a peace activist, as an advocate for peace, because conquering territories and building empires creates stability, and then you have peace within that enlarging empire, as long as you keep attacking other countries. You got to have that continuing, and you'll have peace. Seems to me Thomas Hobbes' rather negative reputation, on the contrary, may be well-deserved. What's your take on that?
Well, I don't want to do too much injustice to Hobbes. I mean, I think he was reflecting on the truth as he understood them at the time that he lived. But historically, how it's come down to us and the way it's been operationalized, it's a very pessimistic narrative when you look at the range of capabilities that human beings possess. You know, is it true that at times we can be self-interested, acquisitive, aggressive, etc.? Of course. But is it also the case that we're capable of great acts of cooperation, collaboration, creating beauty, etc.? Yes. And so, you know, to deny either side of that narrative, I don't think helps us. But to take one side of it, namely the aggressive, self-interested side, and turn that into the norm of a society, and indeed a global society, and make that the currency that has the most salience, and even prioritize it and institutionalize it and grant it benefits when it's displayed, I think is a mistake. It becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy at a point where then you point around the culture and you say, of course, look, you know, Hobbes was right. People behave in that manner. Well, that's because we've created a culture that prioritizes those values. I don't ascribe to that view. I think it's more complicated than that. I'm not advocating some version of human nature that says, you know, it's all great and we've, you know, we all figured it all out. That's not the idea. The ideal society would not be one in which conflict is not present. It would be one in which conflict is present, but it becomes a driver for creative change, that we're learning how to process conflict and transform it and utilize it for growth, not one that becomes destructive, where every conflict potentially puts our very existence in jeopardy and calls forth our worst instincts. So, you know, what we're trying to do is, as peace activists and environmental activists, I think, is put things more in a balance. You know, the Hobbesian narrative is a very powerful one, and you can see how it plays out in texts like the one you mentioned. I don't ascribe to the version of peace that has this hegemonic quality, that if we could just have one lockstep, you know, imperial power, then suddenly that would bring peace. Or even the binary version of it, you know, that was sort of thought to have endured during the Cold War, that we were constantly on the edge, but there was a détente between binary powers, and the loss of that has somehow opened up a more dangerous world. I don't really ascribe to those views. I think they're very short-sighted, and they require a constant sense of threat to keep their to keep themselves going. You know, you can't, it's not static, and so there's always new frontiers to conquer and new people to displace, new resources to acquire. It's an ongoing proposition, and eventually the problem is that it reaches its theoretical, historical, and environmental limits, and then at that point, you know, what happens? The whole hegemonic facade starts to fracture, and people begin, you know, looking inward instead of outward, and the cycle just continues. So it's not the kind of peace that I think most of us in the peace world are looking for. I think a more durable form of peace is one based on ecological principles, including diversity and whole system thinking, the ways that all parts of a whole mutually interact and reinforce one another, and thinking about how, you know, an issue of injustice anywhere, as Martin Luther King said, is an issue of justice everywhere. And getting that sense of peace, I think, is a much more complicated and difficult one, but ultimately it's one that will actually sustain.
So sustainability, or rather stability, is something that you talk about in the book as an aim for those wanting peace in the world. But you talk about environmental sustainability as a way to get there, and also egalitarianism as a way to get there. Can you elaborate on how that works?
Sure. So, you know, stability in the context of change, I think, is the goal. And that's, I think, the overarching goal of most healthy systems, whether they're social systems or environmental systems. It's also part of Aldo Leopold's land ethic that, you know, something is beneficial or right to the extent that it promotes stability, integrity, and beauty. And you know, conversely, what we're seeing in the world today is a form of gross destabilization. Oftentimes, what destabilizes our environmental base is, in fact, you know, inequality of a profound sort, where every resource becomes a commodity to support human growth and expansion, but not all humans. And so you find ourselves, we find ourselves increasingly reliant upon inputs from faraway places without, being cognizant of the impacts of our actions, even though we kind of know in some part of ourselves that many of the things we're consuming, some for luxury and some for necessity, are having impacts on peoples and habitats all around the world, but we compartmentalize that. It becomes somehow other. It's outsourced. It exists in the middle of the ocean or up in the sky. It's not really our doing. And I think the inequality is part of how we cope with that, that to some extent, you know, if we take that Hobbesian view that it's a world of winners and losers, we'd rather be the winners. And so the consciousness of the impacts that our actions have on ourselves and the environment become somehow remote, or maybe it's even included in a narrative that suggests that things have always been this way, and who are we to think about changing it? I find those kind of narratives and stories to be somewhat seductive and yet, fallacious, and I think it's important to resist them, and one of the things I try to do in the book, in addition to citing examples and offering different ways of thinking about these problems, is to try and construct, or at least add my voice to a growing set of voices constructing another narrative, another set of ideas and ways of looking at these problems that hopefully give us another kind of ideological architecture in which to operate in the world.
One of the narratives that you changed for me in the book was that of Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons, which I, like many people, remember being taught about in elementary school and just sort of holding in the background in my head for all these years. But actually, as you explain, it doesn't make much sense the way it's told. Can you sort of briefly rewrite the story of the Tragedy of the Commons?
So it's another variation on the theme, and it's another seductive narrative, namely that if we leave some resource, whether it's an old-growth forest or a grazing pasture or a shared water source, etc., if we leave it unowned, that is, that anybody has rights of access to it in some way, either anybody meaning everyone using it in a closed system or even thrown wide open to the whole world, the theory is that people will obviously despoil it in relatively short order, because without any checks and balances or, you know, normative regulation, it'll just be open season, and, you know, people will come in and they'll overfish the pond and they'll cut down all the trees and they'll take all the resources. So Hardin's formulation is basically that the solution to that tragedy of the commons, that an unregulated shared resource will quickly crash because people can't be trusted to manage themselves, besides being empirically false in most cases, which is something that Eleanor Ostrom showed in her work and others have explored at great length. Besides being empirically false, Hardin's solution becomes another self-fulfilling prophecy. He basically says the solution to the tragedy of the commons is thus to privatize the commons and give everyone an individual stake and then let them have their own parcel, which they can exploit as they see fit, but somehow that would preserve the whole commons. And of course, exactly the opposite is the case, that under the regime of privatization, we see even more gross forms of exploitation of resources and more lack of regard for the whole systems approach that it takes to keep complex watersheds intact and forests intact. So Hardin's solution is to, rather than await this so-called tragedy of the commons, is to cut to the chase, privatize it, and get rid of the commons, and then that will somehow save it. It's a very paradoxical and illogical way of thinking about these things, and yet it's another one of those narratives that has become part and parcel of how we often do business in the world. I tend to, you know, again, take an opposite view, and so I titled the chapter in the book, The Triumph of the Commons, as a way of expressing the idea that, in fact, reclaiming commons-based systems and reinvigorating our capacity to be governed by good sense and mutual interdependence can be a solution to some of the problems that we see today.
I think that is extremely well said. I wonder what to do, you know, because when I speak with a peace studies academic, I usually find myself wanting to go off and establish an environmentally sustainable community and an organic garden and a local currency and living better sort of locally. And when I speak with a peace activist, I find myself wanting to rush to Washington to protest the latest bombing of Iraq or Syria or God knows what list of countries. There seems to be a divide between these two approaches and these two communities of advocates. What should I be doing?
Both, right away. I don't think that there is a divide. I mean, an act of protest and creative demonstration is prefiguring a better society. There should be an element of constant reinvention and protest in our better vision of what the world could be. And at the same time, an act of setting up local sustainable communities and regrounding our lives in the things that matter and starting to produce some of our own resource base, you know, with others, that's also an act of protest in many ways to the, you know, massification of culture and the, you know, agribusiness controlling the food supply and all those things. So I don't see them as being separate. I think a healthy society should have the vision and the action. You know, this in some ways goes back to Gandhi's insight that a true movement for change needs both an obstructive and a constructive program. And sometimes in the annals of peace activism, that constructive program has been a little bit lost. I think to some extent we're more familiar with the obstructive program, the idea of people, you know, withdrawing their consent or cooperation and using the tools of mass demonstration and nonviolent civil disobedience and all of that, which needs to happen. I mean, you have to interrupt oppression and degradation. You can't just let it go unchecked and retreat to some pristine place. There is no such place. Even if there was such a place, it's not a strategy for promoting change. So you need to do that. But it also needs to be coupled with the constructive program, the reclaiming of the material base of our lives. For Gandhi, that was the spinning wheel, you know, learning how to spin cloth and weave his own clothing. That was a very aesthetic example of that, but it indicated the ability for people to start to think about how to procure things themselves. It wasn't just stopping the empire, it was also finding ways to create salt and create cloth and model what a constructive, more egalitarian, decentralized, et cetera, village-based society would look like. So I think they go hand in hand. I've never seen them as being separate. I don't think the peace community has really separated them, except for the fact that it hasn't always modeled that second part of the constructive program quite as well in terms of connecting it back to the essence of protest culture.
It does seem like something we need to work on. And of course, that was defunding a bit of the empire as well to pursue a constructive alternative. The Peace and Justice Studies Association that you're the director of, I don't know much about it. What is the association and what has it been doing?
It's a professional association of mostly academics, but not exclusively. It includes practitioners, scholars, advocates, whole range of folks. It's basically a shared space to develop the field of peace and justice studies, to compare notes and best practices, sharing scholarly information, building up a sense of shared knowledge and history. It functions as many other professional associations do, with networking opportunities. We hold an annual conference, which we just had in the University of San Diego last weekend. And, you know, it's a very dynamic group, willing to engage challenging questions and ask its members to be part of something rather than just kind of send in a check and list it on their CV. The idea is to be actively engaged and help help chart a path. Obviously, with words like peace and justice in the title, we tend to wade into challenging questions that are, you know, complex and require complex responses. And that's part of the values-laden nature, I think, of peace and justice work, whether it's activism work or academic work. There seems to be that willingness to together roll up our sleeves and try to confront the issues rather than just take a passive approach. So you know, the distinction between academics and activism. Sometimes there's some overlap there, I think, that that can get lost in the shuffle. And with PJSA, that's our acronym, I see that clearly because most people in the association, I think, would, even the ones that are teaching and writing primarily for a living, I think many would consider themselves activists at the same time. And in fact, many do participate in more direct forms of activism. So it's a great association to be with. I've been there since 2008, and you know, I've certainly been fortunate to be brought into contact with many people that I've admired in the field for years. And it, you know, it's been great to fill the role as executive director and help keep things moving and help create that container so people affiliated with it can continue to do their work in the world.
And it's a growing field, is it not?
I think so. I mean, in the last couple of decades, we've seen a proliferation of justice studies, peace and justice studies programs. They're kind of variations on a theme. It depends how you, you know, how you ascribe their, you know, their title. But sometimes it's peace and conflict studies, peace and justice studies. But they're all interconnected forms of discipline, or interdiscipline, I should say, because it's not a disciplinary field. It derives from a lot of different sources. But there has been a proliferation in the past few decades at many universities with minors in certificate programs, majors, graduate programs coming online. It is a growing field. I think, you know, a couple of reasons for that are that it does, as I was saying before, it does somewhat unflinchingly wade into questions that are not as easy to wade into in some other fields. But it's also that inter-trans, multidisciplinary perspective on issues that, since we're not limited to one mode of inquiry, we're able to bring to bear many ways of looking at complex problems and, you know, able to draw from a wide range of sources and inspirations that I think, you know, fits the nature of the times, that we're not living in a monolithic world in many ways, even though it often sometimes will have that appearance, you know, of being like there's only one way of doing things. It's actually a world of you know, great fragmentation to some extent, and a lot of different ways of being. And so encapsulating all that, looking at complex problems in complex ways, I think is part of our challenge, and fields like peace and justice studies, you know, tend to do that pretty well. And it's really, you know, it's a great thing to be able to work in a field like that and constantly be learning as we go, and have opportunities to talk with people like yourself and get to know, you know, the work of others along the way. So it's a great thing, and I'm glad to see the field growing, and I think student interest is high as people start to realize the conjoined nature of the challenges that we face.
Well, I am very glad that you are in that position and that you have written this book, which I think everyone needs to pick up a copy of immediately, Peace Ecology by Randall Amster. Randall Amster is the director of the Program on Justice and Peace at Georgetown University and executive director of the Peace and Justice Studies Association. Randall, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me, David.
We will have a link up to Randall Amster's book and to other related resources at talknationradio.org. This week, October 25th to 31st, is the International Week of Action for Military-Free Education and Research. You can find a link to that at worldbeyondwar.org. November 6th is the International Day for Preventing the Exploitation of the Environment in War and Armed Conflict. You can find a link at worldbeyondwar.org as well. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.